man. There's a beverage here, huh?
Does anybody here know how many times I've had to watch Funny Lady?
I'm gonna get that gun of mine, and I'm gonna change you from a rooster to a hen with one shot.
What's up? How you doing? How's everyone feeling? Welcome to another episode of Who Shot Ya? I'm your host, Iffy Whitey Way, and sitting in the virtual booth with me are my friends. So let me introduce them to you. First up, we have Alonzo Duralde. Alonzo, what's good?
Oh, I wish I could say haircuts, but I haven't had one in 4 months. I'll tell you what's good, and I know this is going to horrify not just the vegan portion of the audience, but a lot of the carnivores as well. Hot dogs. I have not had a hot dog in ages, and I was recently watching Amazon Prime has these great collections of what they call ephemeral films. You know, they're old like classroom movies and old sort of, you know, industrial films. There's one that's all drive-in ads, like the ads that would show at a drive-in movie theater between the features. And almost all of them, of course, are about please go to the snack bar and buy a lot of things. Mm-hmm. And they're always pushing the hot dogs. And I just saw so many like gorgeous 1950s hot dog images that I was like, oh my God, I'm going to get some hot dogs. So we did and had them. And, you know, they did not disappoint.
You can't beat a hot dog. Beat a hot dog.
There's no shame here on your hot dog game.
Thank you.
Yeah. Someone once asked, like, what's the difference between a hot dog and a sausage? So now I have that information in the back of my head. And it's that all hot dogs are bratwurst, but not all but sausages are a variety of different types, if I remember correctly.
Or is it the other way around?
No. I think you got it. It's a yeah. Oh, okay. The hot dog is a specific subsection of sausage.
Yeah.
Yes. That wasn't a leading the witness kind of question.
Don't worry. I typed in D and it's still in my saved search difference between hot dog and sausage.
No.
Which we'll be talking on our other show, the Weenie Cast.
Yeah. Who sauced ya? Oh, man. And the other friend who's sitting in this virtual booth with me is none other than Drea Clark. Drea, what's good?
You can tell that we're still in lockdown, as we should be as respectful Americans concerned about our communities. But that mine is also around what I'm consuming in my home space. And what's good for me is that I have really put a concerted effort into my beverage game. And I don't drink coffee, and I'm not much of a like alcohol consumer. So normally when I'm home, I mean, not to brag, I just drink water. Fun times at Casa Clark. So now that I'm not going to restaurants and anything anymore, it's truly become a joy for me. Like, I got some San Pellegrino Lemonada, and I will do half and half of that and a seltzer water and some ice cubes. I'll put a lemon rind in there. Like, I've really tried to, like, make my beverages something special since I'm serving them to myself. And I also use my, I use ice more than normal, and I'm using my metal straw all the time. And you guys, it's really fancy feeling.
My friend, ooh, Gary talks about having, he goes, I like it when I open my fridge and there is a fun soda for me to enjoy. So that's become like kind of our motto for this whole thing. Is there a fun soda for me to enjoy? Yes. Good.
Oh, yeah. I don't drink soda either. So it's been a big mix of things. This, by the way, sounds like I'm like, oh, you guys, just such a health nut. No, no. I'm just real picky.
Yeah. You're washing down your hot dogs with the limonada. Yes.
Yes, exactly.
I just got a case of Topo Chico. I'm very excited.
Ooh.
Oh, okay.
A1.
Iffy, yes. What is good with you?
Well, what's up, y'all? You know, and so, you know, I think the easiest way to do what's good for me is to stop saying things and just read off my Amazon orders. So I think I've already reported all the Blu-rays I got up until Godzilla, King of the Monsters, and Shin. And, you know, I got the Kimmicks and the scale because I was like, well, what better time to step up your pour over coffee game than during the teen? I've already sang the praises of the air fryer attachment to the Instant Pot, a thing most people didn't know about. And I think I might have hinted at getting a SodaStream AquaFizz because I needed that. So for this rendition of What's Good, we're going to go to page one, because those were page two and three of my orders. And I will let you know that I got Joy Jolt Spirits stemless wine glasses, because I was like, it's time to step up my wine. And the reason I have to step up my wine is because I'm back on keto, and there's a very specific, they get real specific on which wines you can have. And the keto wines are a Sauvignon Blanc, a Pinot Noir, and Chardonnay. I also got a you've heard me hint at how good Casey's beard, how good Alonzo's beard is. Well, guess what? Enough is enough. I bought the beard growth kit, beard derma roller, and beard balm facial hair growth kit.
Oh my
so
god.
So I'm using a beard kit. I'm not seeing any results.
Is this like the rabbit of Seville, where he puts the fertilizer on Elmer Fudd's face and it all pops out like flowers?
Yeah. I mean, I hope so. But that was my ritual. And you feel really dumb kind of rolling, because it's like the derma roller is really just like these kind of like small, like, pointy
needles.
Oh,
you know
needles.
I have a derma roller.
Yeah. And it's supposed to stimulate your beard follicles. Growth by like, yeah. And
that's not why I use mine.
All right, y'all. Well, you know, today we're going to be talking about the King of Staten Island, and we're taking a call from the Who Shot line, and of course, we're going to have them staff picks, but first, it's the return of our news segment, Itadic, short for Is This Important? Do I Care? Each of us will read a news segment and answer the question, Is This Important? Do I Care? The first thing up, we're talking about Marissa Tomei, formerly known as Marissa Tomei, who regrets shifting to mom roles. In a recent interview with Collider, talking about the new movie that we'll be discussing today, The King of Staten Island, actress Marissa Tomei said she regretted moving into mom roles. She's quoted saying, "I really regret starting down this road, and I really regret starting to do that. I was, you know, talked into it. Not this, but I mean, just that change. And I really always feel like, oh, I could play a lot of things." And when asked about what kind of roles she wishes to play, she says, even genres that I would love to be in, the femme fatale in a noir. And I still think there are other aspects of even romantic comedies. I really love them. But, you know, really at a screwball level, there's so many, the breadth of so much woman, there's so many roles. Is this important? Do you care?
I care. Mm-hmm. And I also want to say that if it's sort of beholden on at least one of us to make a comment of how iffy would like to envision her in a stepmom role. like, if I didn't make that easy
who
joke.
Who needs her pool cleaned?
Yeah, I feel badly about that later. I think it's interesting because what I think Marissa Tomei, I'll just speak for her. What I think what she's actually getting at is less how stepping into mom roles could be something to regret as an actor because of the pigeonhole, but also just the dearth of roles for women over the age of even 30 in this town, although most 30-year-olds are playing high school students still, but that if you're playing a character age 30 and up and they're in a film, most of the time they're a mother. And mm-hmm. I think it's more the absence of having a lot of fun, and like the movie she referenced, like playing a film fatale, being in a noir, being in a romantic comedy, like a screwball comedy. I would love to see Marissa Tomei back in that saddle. Like mm-hmm. her is it Crazy Sexy Love? Crazy, I always conflate it with the TLC.
Crazy Stupid Love. Oh, yeah.
Crazy Stupid Love. Yep.
Crazy Sexy Love.
You see the TLC mistake. Yeah. I mean, but like her in Crazy Stupid Love, she was so wonderful and manic, and she has so many actresses have so much to offer, and there's kind of this fine small baby pool of Oscar caliber stuff that will maybe not be mom roles, but they'll be historical women or like, you know, women who are going through either a medical crisis or, you know, falling apart psychologically. But I hope that it's not she regrets playing moms. I think I want to think it's that she regrets really only having mom options. because yeah. that's how women are seen.
Yeah, that's kind of how I took it. Is there's this weird like line that you step over as an actress or a female actor, where if you're a mom, then that's your lane now, and that's all people want to cast you as, and that's all people want to see you as. Whereas if you're an older man, you get to be, you still get that versatility. You get to be a John Wick, you get to be a James Bond, but then you can also play a dad in some. You get to be the angry dad in Who's Coming to Dinner. And it's just that kind of, once again, that double standard in Hollywood. Because, you know, the way she looks in Spider-Man, yeah, in the Spider-Man films to this one, like, you can tell they really did try and make her look mom in this one, where, like, since in the Spider-Man, her thing's being a hot mom, you can see the versatility where it's like, aunt. Yeah, she can still play, like, the love interest in anything, and she can play a leading lady in a Atomic Blonde-esque movie, and once again, we need to be making more Atomic Blonde-esque movies.
Well, as Goldie Hawn, who should know, memorably mm-hmm. noted in the First Wives Club, there are three ages of women in Hollywood: babe, district attorney, driving Miss Daisy. And yeah, Marissa Tomei is a babe, but if Hollywood has decided that she's district attorney, then, you know, we have to fight the power.
It's also my last bit on this is, it's also commentary of like women outside of roles. If you're a mom, you are no longer fun or sexy or a criminal or a femme fatale or whatever. You are just a mom, full stop, which is super insulting.
Yes. So last week, HBO Max pulled Gone with the Wind from its streaming service after filmmaker John Ridley penned an op-ed in the Los Angeles Times asking for the film to be taken down. This past week, the chairman of Warner Media, which owns HBO Max, Bob Greenblatt, spoke on the Jess Cagle show about why he decided to take it off the streaming site and why it's okay for Turner Classic Movies to show the film. Greenblatt said, TCM talked about some of the racial stereotypes and some of the issues with how the Civil War is portrayed, which is much more positive than focusing on slavery, the darker side of that issue. If it was on the linear network, it wouldn't need it, because they're often talking about these issues. We failed to put the disclaimer in there, which sets up the issue, basically the issues that this movie really brings up. He also said the movie would return to the site eventually once they figure out how to present it in a culturally sensitive way. Is this important? Do you care?
Oh, I'll have an opinion right away again. I'm happy. I like to test the water. I do think this is important. When this first came out and I saw that it was just pulled, I hadn't yet read his larger statement, and I had a very knee-jerk concern over something being pulled for the negativity that it was representing, and that having that just be the full stop reaction to it. Discovering that they were addressing the fact that they put this film without context, without either cultural or historical knowledge coming with it, because to me, that's the important part of it. Like, if you're just pulling stories and then it just puts everything in this like good or bad category, that is troubling for me. But I think that, you know, part of what we as storytellers, or we as people in media, are we in media, you guys? Are we the media? But I think part of our role is this added context of having the larger conversation and being able to dissect Gone with the Wind, a film that's been on this like pedestal for so long, mm-hmm. to finally like be able to call out in an engaged, informed manner, here are the positives, but also please let's talk about all of these things that were red flags, that are problematic, that are hurtful and harmful. I think that's just as important. So I what was important to me truly about this was discovering that they were trying to hopefully remedy that. And I do hope that's where they end up.
I know it's interesting to me because like, well, first off and foremost, shocker, I have not seen Gone with the Wind, so I don't know the levels in which this goes through, but there is like the element of like, you know, every film has this, right? Like every film decades behind has something that's out. Like we just did a series of films where the first film comes out with a guy calling someone a hard F-bomb, and I'm not talking about fuck because we can say that on this show. and we all were like, yeah, even though back then it still was like, ooh, that's, you're doing that even then. But like the cursory knowledge of Gone with the Wind, I'm gonna leave this to Dre and Alonzo. Do you feel, I think I'm gonna just listen to this one. Do you feel it needs a, well, this movie made in 1940 looks like a movie made in 1940.
Yeah, I mean, look, you know, Disney Plus, we kind of goofed on their whole outdated cultural representations thing, but I think that's a fair cop in terms of saying, like, this is a film which, like all art, has to be considered in the context of the time in which it was made. In, I want to say 2009, when the film had its 70th anniversary, I did a couple of articles about it for MSNBC.com. And I went back and did the research and sort of was looking into, you know, how it was taken over the years. And, you know, there were NAACP protests about it at certain like reissues and whatnot. But then at the same time, you know, I assumed incorrectly that there would be this sort of like monolithic black response about the film that was negative. But what I discovered is that there are all kinds of different analyses and viewpoints about it. Donald Bogle, who is a leading scholar in talking about black cinema and black representation in Hollywood cinema, is a fan of the movie. And he says that that Hattie McDaniel's Mammy character is actually a really positive portrayal of a kind of strong black woman that existed in this horrible period of American history. So I'm with Drea. I'm more of the school of like, let's not hide things. Let's not pretend they didn't happen. But if we're going to make them available to a mass audience, let's contextualize them. Let's talk about where they came from and when they came from and why they happened in the first place and what we know now or what we have decided as a society now that we had not decided as a society, you know, 75 years ago. So, you know, I want people to be able to see Gone with the Wind, but I also want people to have to kind of go through the hoops of understanding Gone with the Wind and not just watching it, you know, cold.
Yeah, got it.
Ooh, it's hard to not make a hoop skirt pun right there.
Yeah,
it's real hard.
Yeah, I mean, but I like that take on it because, you know, we wanna like, you know, present it as is, maybe not do a rethink rendition in it. Something like Stephen King is thinking of with the Friday the 13th, right?
Oh man, that's crazy. It's like you read my mind. So yes, this past week, Stephen King took to Twitter to reveal an idea he has been brewing. Quote, "The best novel idea I never wrote and probably never will is I, Jason, the first person narrative of Jason Voorhees and his hellish fate, killed over and over again at Camp Crystal Lake. What a hellish existential fate." He likes the phrase hellish fate. He goes on to say, quote, "Just thinking about the legal thicket one would have to go through to get permissions makes my head ache and my heart, that too. But gosh, shouldn't someone tell Jason's side of the story? Blumhouse could do it as a movie." Hey guys, is this important? Do you care?
This is the hyper-professional, successful, old white man version of, "If I made this, would y'all watch it?" Like, that's one of the things I hate is, like, in the improv community, people will always do their, like, sketch premises and be like, "If I made this, would anybody watch it?" And that's totally what Stephen King is doing here. And, like, oh, the world's biggest writer positing this idea and talking about the legal thicket as if they're into it, they'd be like, "Well, we'll sign off."
If only you had an army of lawyers, Stephen King, to make this thing happen.
Yeah. You know what would probably make it easier? If you were Stephen King. Yeah. I do like this as a concept. I think the idea of a first person switch. I mean, listen, if the author of Twilight did that for Edward Cullen, then certainly Jason Voorhees deserves the same treatment.
I mean, yeah, Friday the 13th has been kind of lying dormant. There was an attempt to do that remake a few years ago, which I did not hate, but it did not sort of do the kind of, it didn't generate the sort of enthusiasm that led to a new franchise. So I'm sure Paramount, who probably still owns all of this, would love for Stephen King. Like, this is such, you're right, this is such a lob of like, what do you think? You know, just throw it out there. It's like, dude, just set up the meeting. Come on.
Right? Like, you could probably pretty easily get to both Blumhouse and Paramount, so...
Yeah. They have you on speed now. Yes. As a matter of fact, they texted you after the tweet. They have your
whatever it is. Yes,
on.
Yes, yes.
Yeah. Bring it in, please. Oh, my gosh. I love it. I love the coyness. Well, then we're going to take a break, and when we come back, we'll be talking about the King of Staten Island just as soon as we hear from another one of the shows on Maximum Fun.
Dead Pilot Society brings you exclusive readings of comedy pilots that were never made, featuring actors like Patton Oswalt.
So the vampire from the future sleeps in the dude's studio during the day, and they hunt monsters at night. It's Blade meets the Odd Couple.
Adam Scott and Jane Levy.
Come on, Corey. She's too serious, too businessy. She doesn't know the hokey pokey.
Well, she'll learn what it's all about.
Busy Phillips and Dave Koechner.
Baby, this is family.
My Uncle Tell, who showed his wiener to Cinderella at Disneyland, is family. Do you want him staying with us?
He did stay with us for 3 months.
And he was a delight.
A new pilot every month, only on Dead Pilot Society for Maximum Fun.
Welcome back to Who Shot You? I'm your host, Ifeanyi Way, and in the studio with me are...
Drea Clark.
Alonzo Duralde.
And today we're talking about the King of Staten Island. Drea, would you mind providing us with a synopsis?
Oh, you betcha! The King of Staten Island follows one Scott Carlin, who's played by Pete Davidson, and it is a thinly veiled, semi-autobiographical role for him. He plays a young man in his mid-20s who is floundering and pot smoking his way through his days. He lost his father, a firefighter, in the line of duty, and has suffered ever since, but in that very silent way that many young men do. He is living with his mother, played by Marissa Tomei, and kind of mooching off her, aimlessly drifting through his life. His younger sister is doing a bit better and heads off to college. And things take a turn when the mother starts dating a firefighter named Ray, played by Bill Burr. And Scott then tries to, you know, immerse himself, meddle in the relationship, break it up, all while figuring out his own things. And he learns about himself, his family, his community in the process. And, you know, a lot of other things, mostly involving firefighters and his amazing array of doofus friends.
Ah, yes, yes, yes. You know, it's I want to ask this first question, because every time I see a question like this, I'm like, oh, this is Casey's voice that I need to make heard, which is, why are Judd Apatow movies so long?
That is the question. No, I was going to say, it's funny that you know, Apatow specializes in movies about white guys who are caught in repetitive patterns and need to learn to break out of them and do something else with their life. And I feel like Judd Apatow's been making the same movie now like 10 times. So it's like, physician, heal thyself. I don't know. I have been forgiving in the past of the length of his movies, because so many of his movies operate in this very sort of organic seeming conversational space. But there were times in this one where I kind of felt like, pick up the pace here, you know?
Yeah, I felt the same way, where there was like, because I enjoyed like a lot of the scenes, lots of moments. I think one of the things that will, that is the funniest kind of like meta joke is the baseball scene where Pete explains his Crohn's, and he said, why'd you say that? And he was like, you know, to spread awareness. Like stuff like that was cute and great. But there are scenes where it's like, all right, like that kind of just feel like I could tell it was put there we're just existing, but it's like, oh, well, I want to see this story progress. Like, I want to get out of this stage.
Did you guys feel, yes, I agree with Alonzo. I was aware of the length of this in a way that never bodes super well for a film. That said, I was happier existing in this sphere. I found Pete Davidson incredibly likable. I understood his appeal much more, and I liked this world and the questions he was going through. And honestly, what it just felt to me like was I felt like I was just marathoning a show that was like Girls or Atlanta or like this movie. It's, you know, it's almost 2 hours, 20 minutes. It truly just feels like six episodes of that kind of dramedy, comedy based, like Singular, Rami. Like there's so many shows that I really like and think are really good. And even the different sections, like, it allows for, there's all these characters that come up and have a couple of scenes and then they drift off and have nothing to do with the resolution. Like his sister, who's played by one of Judd Apatow's daughters.
Maud Apatow. Maud,
yeah. She does a great job, and there's this whole rich and complicated history between the brother and sister that you get a touch of, and you see her, but she's really in it sort of twice, and then it she's not, you know, when you look at an edit and you're always, if you're giving notes on a screenplay and you're always advising things like, does every scene either move the story forward or tell us something completely different about the character? And half of these scenes do not. They're certainly enjoyable, or there's just, you know, things worthy in them. But I truly just in my head was just thinking of it like I was marathoning a show.
So you're saying the home viewing experience actually kind of works with the structure here. Okay.
Yes, because I honestly, and I was doing a little jigsaw puzzle on my phone for a while as I was watching it, and I really enjoyed it. I was like, this is great, these people. But it was the,
and
the,
oh look, kittens.
Yeah, the length of these films, to me, it's that Judd Apatow is like uninterested in editing his ideas. And you know, we've also discussed in the past that so many things based on real life stuff people will leave in because they're like, well, mm-hmm. that's how it happened, or that, you know, that part of it was significant to me. When in this kind of film, you're like, well, sure, but we just want the stuff that's good for the audience. And so, yeah, it becomes a bit belabored, but in a way that, like, again, I enjoyed most of it, was just thinking, oh, you're in the wrong format. Sorry, dude.
So I'm just curious, Rhea, if in your festival travels, if you encountered the movie Big Time Adolescence at all.
Oh, yeah. It was my staff pick a month and a half ago. Yeah.
So I kind of feel like, all right, so we now have two movies where Pete Davidson is basically playing Pete Davidson, which is fine. And he does it very well. I'm a little curious as to, like, does he want to be an actor? Is he interested in being an actor? Because you're right, he's super charismatic. I find him really charming in these films. But he's also operating in a very sort of relatively safe space. And so I wonder if this is even something he wants to do. And if he does, what's that going to look like?
Yeah, no, I was saying that's a real good point, because he seems to really be acting in that corner of, like, that same energy of someone doing playing themselves in a self-titled show about their comedy career. like it's that same energy, but it's like really likable, because walking down, oh, let me grab a pizza, oh, I'm walking into this place that is an SNL, it has a different name, but we know it's SNL. But this one, Bill Burr steals the show. Mandalorian, Bill Burr steals the show. Like, he's really kind of coming into his own.
Yeah.
And it was really fun watching him play like the serious, but like kind of warming up to this guy, like watching that journey. And I think that'd be like, I think that's kind of Bill's corner, because he has that hella Bostonian accent. I don't think we're ever going to see him as the Huxtable dad.
Bill Burr is not going to be in a Coen Brothers film.
Yeah, yeah.
I totally never know. Agree. Yeah. I also, not as a native Minnesotan, I should have said. I agree. And one of the reasons I like Bill Burr's character is actually in a different way, but a similar thing of something I liked about Pete Davidson from the beginning in this role, which is, again, very similar to him, is he, from the second you see him, and maybe it's a reason I was allowing him a little more sympathy, he is clearly someone who is so emotionally damaged and prone to addiction, or in the throes of addiction, has mental health issues, is clearly depressed. And me, I would so much rather watch a young guy in the sort of Pete Davidson mold whose insecurity comes across as him just like, he makes himself the butt of every joke. Like, there's no, the false bravado in an obnoxious, arrogant way of dudes that age is like, ugh, makes me cringe and die. This is the opposite. This is a guy who's like, oh, I'm not worth much. You know that. Everybody knows that. It's fine. I know that. I'm not worth much. And the Bill Burr side of it, you know, he's this paragon of whatever, but he's also a masculine character who, and all of the other guys in the firehouse who are there in this like vulnerable and emotionally sharing way. And I was grateful for the shades of masculinity that this movie unexpectedly gave me.
Well, I think that's part of the Apatow wheelhouse and a thing that I've admired about his films. And I think, you know, he follows in that, you know, I've talked about this in other places, the Kevin Smith tradition in terms of not only people who are sort of smart and articulate, but also profane. But I think also in sort of questioning the idea about what we think about masculinity. Like, even when his movies aren't specifically queer, they are at least providing, you know, he kind of gave us the bromance as we know it now in movies. So like this idea of sort of a homosocial relationship where dudes are able to be emotionally intimate with each other and to share with each other and to support and understand each other in a way that isn't just constantly sort of like preening and like out to kind of kneecap each other. And I think the other thing that he does really well that manifests here is he and his casting directors always put together these really amazing ensembles. And he's very good at working with actors. So, you know, you've got Davidson doing terrific work, you know, Tomei and Burr are terrific. But then you've also got like, you know, Steve Buscemi, who's of course always good, but, you know, he's fun to watch.
Yeah.
You know, the friends, including Moises Arias, who's an actor I like a lot. Bell Powley is,
oh,
for
my
me,
God.
The
yeah.
MVP of this movie. I adore her. I adore her character. I love that she's not just the girl, you know, and she's not just a prize to be won. Although winning her is going to mean that Davidson's character has to get his shit together to deserve her, basically.
Yeah.
So I you know, she's an actress who every time she pops up, I'm just like, oh yeah, you're killing it, and she's killing it again and again, doing a flawless accent. You know, she's one of those Brits that just like hears it and nails it. You know, I always bought her as somebody from Staten Island, and so I don't want to seem like I'm shitting on this movie, even though I think there are issues with it. I think there's a lot of what Apatow does well that he's still doing here.
Yeah.
Weird random thing I just want to throw out.
That's what we're here for.
Of course.
Yeah.
So my good friends Nathan Rabin and Clint Worthington do a podcast called Travolta Cage, where they are working their way through the filmographies of our two greatest actors, Nicolas Cage and John Travolta. And I'm guesting on this week's show, and coincidentally where they are in the sequence of Cage movies is we talked about this basically Cinemax movie called Zandali. It's this like ridiculous softcore, like
New
heavy
Orleans.
Breathing fest.
Yeah.
Marissa Tomei and Steve Buscemi share a title card in the opening credits. They're both in it.
Oh, what?
Like,
oh,
this is a movie full of people who are way too good to be in this stupid ass movie. And they include Steve Buscemi and Marissa Tomei, weirdly enough.
Yeah.
All right. I got to put an ad in it on the Zandali.
Yeah. It's free on Tubi.
It's bonkers.
This poster.
Uh-huh.
Oh, if you would just at least look at this poster, you got Nicolas Cage, Judge Reinhold, Erica Anderson, Zandali.
It's a doozy.
So do you guys think, like, going back to our critiquing the lengths of the Judd Apatow films, do you think that's ever going to change? And what would you have gotten rid of in this one?
It wouldn't be an easy cut. Like, I know there's some movies we talk about where I'm like, oh, right off the bat, cut that. But it definitely is, because there are some things that are, you know, I think this, when we're talking about repetition, there are some moments that we hit on often to show, like, he keeps messing up, he keeps doing this. And there probably would be, like, some of those that I'd be like, okay, like, I get he's a fuck up. We don't need to see him fuck up again. You know?
Yeah, maybe one of the basement scenes where they're like high and wild playing video games, like, we get
I would watch 4 hours of that. Like, you just described Twitch, so...
Yeah. Oh, well, you know what? You know what? I smoke after I stream, not before. I keep the stream clean so you get this sober content, and then I smoke weed and play four more hours of video games. But yeah, no, this was real fun, and, you know, a lot of... Yeah, there were so many, like... Great cameos, breakout stars. Action Bronson is the person who got stabbed.
When he wandered into the thing, I was like, I'm sorry, is that Action Bronson?
Oh, yeah. The action bropper, chef slash rapper, Action Bronson, who was stabbed. Maybe vape pen blew up. Maybe that was a real
thing. This is the director that gave us LeBron. Is a LeBron James, yes. Right? In comedy star. So anything is possible.
Yeah. That is the only white rapper featured that's good. But I must mention that Machine Gun Kelly also was in there as a tattooing. The biggest Nazi, which, like, also that those tattoos seem real. It didn't seem like hair and makeup went on. So that means
specifically done. They were just done better than the terrible tattoos that Pete Davidson makes.
Yeah. Like, but I was like, because I saw the 8-8 and I was like, oh, this dude's a straight up Nazi.
He had a full array of red flags all over his body.
Yeah, yeah.
Literal Confederate flags, yeah.
I mean, I do like that they did give us Pete Davidson shitting on him.
Yeah,
I was like, because it was great. I was like, yes, Pete Davidson, please don't let this man murder you, though.
Yeah,
this is the hugest Nazi I've seen in a while, and I've seen an 8-foot statue of Hitler. Let's give our final review. So for our final review of The King of Staten Island, would you screen it? Stream it? Or skip it.
In the interest of Screen It still being our highest, I really enjoyed this movie. I would say Screen It for me. Like I said, it feels more like you're kind of binging an episodic series, but I'm someone who likes doing that. So it worked out. I found it fun and thoughtful and, you know, certainly not perfect, but I enjoyed my time with it.
I'm somewhere in the middle because, like, I do think people should see it. I think there is a lot that's great about it, but I think it's also, I don't know. I feel like it could be tightened up, and I often feel like as much as Pete Davidson is playing a version of himself, this movie is Judd Apatow doing another version of this Judd Apatow movie that he makes. You know, the sort of coming of age man child movie. So I think ultimately I'm going to go stream it. But, you know, I think stream it does include the notion of, like, it is something you should watch. And so I think it is.
Oh, wait, can I add in before you say, in case you better not cut this out? I've never in my life watched anything where I wanted to fix someone's slouch more. Pete Davidson posture in this movie is something to factor in when you're deciding to watch it, because it is with you.
This was a Screen It for me. Lots of fun moments. I really, you know, there isn't a Marissa Tomei movie that's going to come across my desk and fall in anywhere besides Screen It, because anytime she's in a movie, you need to be screening
it. Wait till you watch Zandali, mister.
Bill Burr, truly delightful. I'm real excited to see what more use people get out of Bill, because I'm really enjoying seeing him in things, and he always surprises me with how he's just rolls with the punches and really gets deep, and watching him get close with Pete was great. A lot of breakouts. A friend of mine, Lou Wilson, that's my boy, you know, Fat Kanye. He's a UCB guy, friend of the pod technically. All around. So I guess the answer here is Screen It, and Marissa Tomei, please respond to my calls. Thank you so much. We'll be right back after we hear from another show for Maximum Fun.
Strange planets, curious technology, and a fantastic vision of the distant future. featuring Martin Starr.
So we're going on day 14. Shuttle still hasn't come.
Aparna Nancherla.
The security system provides you with emotional security. You do the rest.
Echo Kellum.
Can you disconnect me or not?
Hari Kondabolu.
I'm staying.
From Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy, Jeffrey McGivern.
Could you play Cyndi Lauper's Girls Just Want to Have Fun?
It's The Outer Reach. Stories from beyond.
Now available for free at MaximumFun.org or anywhere you listen.
Welcome back to Who Shot You? I'm your host, Ifeoyi Way. In the studio with me are...
Alonzo Duralde.
Drea Clark.
And now it's time to answer a call from the Who Shot line. So, you know what I'm about to say. Casey, play that call.
Hi, this is Coralie from Seattle, and I am a proud LGBTQ member, and I'm starting to try and wrap my head around having a Pride Month where I am responsibly socially distancing. So I just wanted to call and see what suggestions you had for some fun, celebratory queer movies. We have our backlog of sad and tragic stories, but what are some good romps, some joyous films that fit in the genre? Love the show. Thanks so much.
Happy
good
Pride!
Question. Happy Pride. Should I take lead on this?
Yes.
Okay, fine. I'll tell you, I have mentioned this before, but I will say again, Tubi, T-U-B-I, at TubiTV.com, has a really deep bench of LGBT stuff. Like, I'm really impressed. It's everything from, so much stuff that I programmed at Outfest, you know, or saw at other queer festivals. And it really runs the gamut from, documentaries and dramas. But you're asking specifically about fun movies, so I will suggest some fun movies on Tubi, just to name a few. And these are all free with ads. They have GBF, which is a really fun teen comedy. It stands for Gay Best Friend. Another teen comedy, Saved. There is Big Eden, which is a really lovely sort of rom-com fantasy about, you know, it's a small town in Montana where they all kind of conspire to you know, get these two shy guys together, basically. And, you know, I'm sure no such small town in Montana exists, but you wish it did. And the filmmaker clearly does as well. And so he's sort of making that happen. You know, the original British Queer as Folk, if you've never seen that, that is running in its entirety on Tubi. So, yeah, there's just a lot of, you know, yeah, if you're in the mood for something that's more serious or that's more, dockish or whatever, then you'll absolutely find that stuff there. But, Fourth Man Out, a movie that I have kind of championed in the last few years, it's just a really goofy comedy about some straight bros and how they respond when, you know, one of their number comes out of the closet, and they take it, you know, better than you might think. Adam and Steve, which is the first film directed by actor Craig Chester, which has a very elaborate musical number in it for a low budget movie. I found that, you know, super impressive, and it's a lot of fun as well. Speaking of Steve Buscemi, Parting Glances, which was his breakthrough movie.
Yeah.
Wonderful comedy drama and like one of my favorite, you know, queer movies of all time. So, yeah, let your fingers do the walking on Tubi. You will find just a whole crazy mix of things. And any of those movies that I mentioned, I think you will have fun with.
I'd add, outside of that, there's a film on Netflix that was randomly suggested that I enjoyed, called The Way He Looks. That's about a blind high school student who falls in love with one of his other classmates. And it's very sweet. The Imagine Me and You is like this big fluffy lesbian rom-com that follows and hits all of the rom-com beats, and I'm a rom-com fan. I will always have a soft spot for The Birdcage. I know that there are like iffy parts of it. Man, I know you hate it when that happens, but I think it's because it's a favorite film of some of my favorite gay couples, and that like one of them painted a whole scene from that movie. So it has a real soft spot for me. Maurice, which we've definitely talked about here before, with Hugh Grant and his floppy hair. But Morris, there was another. What's the? I'm like, Alonzo, get in my head. There's definitely. Oh, we Alonzo has also mentioned Debs, which is
yes.
Just a fun lesbian random romp. But I'm a Cheerleader has a nice like campy quality and some.
That's on Tubi and on Criterion Channel right now.
Oh, perfect. Yeah, there you go.
And to pick up what you said about Netflix, you know, the half of it, which we just talked about, yes. is a delight, as is Alice Wu's first film, Saving Face, which you can rent. And, you know, Netflix is, you know, they've got some lovely stuff like Alex Strangelove and Let It Snow, which was a, you know, Christmas movie. But, you know, I'll watch those any time of year. And that's got a really great lesbian subplot in it. And of course, you know, Love, Victor just dropped on Hulu, which I've not had a chance to watch yet, but I'm very looking forward to.
And the movie Pride. That's my last one.
Oh, good
one. I recommend it for everybody for Pride. It's based on this gay coalition helping out the striking miners in England. And it's got that very British, all those comedic British historical fictions that are like, oh, how do we make this terrible thing kind of upbeat
and charming
super super charming.
I mean, you know, I have to, you know, obviously leave it to y'all because, you know, I think the only movie that comes to mind, and I don't know if it holds up like it did back in the day, but Tu Wong Fu, Thanks for Everything. I feel like is that a good addition into the wrong, or is that
It is on Netflix.
It is an addition that's on Netflix. I haven't seen that since forever either, so I couldn't.
Yeah,
Look. Admittedly, I'm not a giant fan. I'm not a giant fan of The Birdcage either. But you know, I'm a cranky gay sometimes when it comes to this stuff. So, if these are movies that you know ring your bell, to far be it for me to yuck your.
I mind. Like that you tried to qualify that you're a cranky gay only when it comes to things like this.
No, I let's be clear. 24/7, I'm a cranky gay.
Oh my gosh. Okay, well that was super fun. Thank you so much for calling in, and thank you to everyone who has called in ever. We love you. The number for the Who Shot line is WSY 803-1664. But now it's time for our staff picks. It could be any movie. In theaters, streaming, what have you. Alonzo, why don't you start?
Well, speaking of queer content on Netflix, I'm very excited. The day that this episode drops, they are dropping a new documentary called Disclosure that premiered at Sundance this year. And it's like The Celluloid Closet, but exclusively about trans representation in film and television, going all the way back to The Silence. And you know, really great interviews with people like Laverne Cox and Zachary Drucker and Jen Richards and Jamie Clayton. And it's just this really, you know, like Celluloid Closet, it is both historical and emotional in its exploration of these images, the good ones, the bad ones, the impact that they've had, the way they've moved society forward, the way they've made life more difficult, you know, for the people involved. I was moved to tears at certain points. I wrote down titles of things that I hadn't heard of and hadn't watched yet that I need to check out. It's really, really great, and I can't recommend it enough. Everybody needs to check it out. And also, there's a cool thing happening I want to plug real quick. Frameline in San Francisco, Inside Out, New Fest, and Outfest, all of these LGBTQ film festivals have gotten themselves together to create NAQFA, the North American Queer Festival Alliance, and they're going to be doing online events basically in place of the festivals that would normally be happening at this time of year, and it's going to kick off on Wednesday. They are doing a Q&A online with a lot of the folks who are involved with Disclosure. And so they're going to be talking to Laverne Cox, who's an executive producer of the film, Sam Fader, who directed it, Jen Richards, Brian Michael Smith, Teek Milan, Candace Kane, Zeke Smith, Zachary Drucker, and more. So Google NAQFA to find out when and where that's going to be happening and see the movie. It's just, I love it so much. Disclosure on Netflix.
I'll back that up. It's fantastic.
Ooh, all right. What about you? What about you,
Treya? Another film out of Sundance that is called Miss Juneteenth, and it comes out obviously on Juneteenth, the 19th, this Friday, the day this episode comes out. It is a first-time feature director, Channing Godfrey Peoples, and you guys know I have a soft spot for directorial debuts, and she does an incredible work establishing this world. It's sort of this impoverished community, and the story centers around an incredible performance by Nicole Beharie as a mostly single mom who was, she won the Miss Juneteenth crown herself in high school, and she's entered her daughter now in the same competition. And it's such a great sort of slice of life film that follows this woman, and you learn about her world and her community, and it's beautifully shot and feels just really authentic and interesting. It's like one of those, oh, I got to visit a part of the country that I've not been, that I haven't seen, a perspective I got, and it's beautiful and enjoyable to watch. So, Miss Juneteenth, please see it and support it. It's it'll be video on demand, so it's the kind of thing where you'll need to rent. But it's also the kind of film that, like, well, every film, but you know, the things that we support with our renting, it pays off in the kinds of films that are made and who gets to continue making films. So, Miss Juneteenth.
Yeah. And then I'll just pick up right from there. You know, my original pick was going to be The Five Bloods, but since we're watching that next week, I'm going to just tell you to definitely watch it so you can get ready for that conversation. But, you know, the second thing that came up to me is, you know, I always love movies that take place in the East Coast area, because there's just that light obsession of just showing that, like, you know, New York scenery all around, the looks. And, you know, I always want to, you know, do that for Los Angeles, the real Los Angeles, not white Los Angeles that we see in movies all the time. You know, you see all the boroughs in movies, but you only see one side of LA. I say this as an LA native. So I had to, of course, highlight a movie that I felt did a good job of giving us a little taste of that. And, you know, also written and directed by a Nigerian brother. So right now, Alonzo Andre already knows what my staff pick is going to be. It's going to be Dope by Rick Fumiyiwa. Fellow Nigerian guy. I was like, I need to email him. That's been my card with all Nigerians in the industry. It was like, hey, how's it going? My brother, it's me. We are Nigerian. Let's talk. What's going on? Huh? What would our father say? Anyway, one of the few times I've watched a movie and I was like, I know what I'm seeing. I've lived what I'm seeing. And if that movie always is going to stick with me, because, you know, I just really relate it so specifically to Shameik Moore's character, who Shameik, you need to get yourself under control. You know what you're doing. That's my staff pick. Check that out. Get all that black film in your brain, and then we're gonna get the Five Bloods in there with you. So this is time for our five-star reviews. Before we go, we're gonna read a five-star review. If you leave us a five-star review on Apple Podcasts, we'll read it on air. But we have no new reviews this week, so I'm forced to read one by producer Casey. Casey sends us, I like it when Alonzo gets mad at Iffy, 5 stars. You can feel free to copy and paste that and use that as a 5-star review.
I never really get mad.
Yeah, it's all for show. But you feel free to copy it and paste that. We would accept it.
Absolutely.
Alonzo, Andrea, thank you for another great show. I truly appreciate y'all.
Thank you, sir.
Is there anywhere people can go back if they missed the Turner Classic Movies thing? Is it online anywhere, or is it on demand?
If you have the Watch TCM app, which I think you have to get TCM on your cable, and you have to get cable, so I know that's a lot of barriers, but if you can access the Watch TCM app, yes, the three movies I showed, which are Our Betters, Victim, and Word Is Out, are there, and the intros and outros are still attached. So if you missed it, please check it out. Thank you.
Please do that. Y'all heard it. Get the app. I know y'all got, there's a couple of y'all still got cable. A couple of y'all, you know, got tricked into it you were just trying to get internet, and they're like, it's going to be cheaper if you get cable. It's going to be cheaper. And then you sign up and you're like, this definitely isn't cheaper, but I guess I'll keep it. So that's y'all know who I'm talking to. Y'all go get that app.
Go to your grandparents' house if you have to.
Yeah. When you're hanging there, ask your grandma. You need to call your grandma anyway.
Yes.
Yeah. You called her. So call her. And then after you check in with her, have a good conversation, ask her what her TCM code is and use that. And again, the number for the Who Shot line is WSY-803-1664. And just a reminder, you can buy the Jumbotron on our show by going to MaximumFun.org/Jumbotron. If you have a comment or suggestion about this week's show, tweet at us at Who Shot Your Pod. Our Facebook group can be found at www.facebook.com/groups/WhoShotYourPodcast, or send us an email at WhoShotYa@MaximumFun.org. Our producer is Casey O'Brien. Our senior producer is Laura Swisher. And this is a production of Maximum Fun.
MaximumFun.org.
Comedy and culture.
Artist owned.
Audience supported.